It's time for Gervie's Law, the intersection of law and life with your host, Alan Gervie. Alan is the managing attorney at the law firm of Rowan, Gervie & Wynn, a workers' compensation law firm which has represented injured workers for over 35 years. And now, here's your host, Alan Gervie.
Good evening. I am Alan Gervie, the managing partner of law firm of Rowan, Gervie & Wynn. And this is Gervie's Law. It's the first time in a long time that I'm actually flying solo because I don't have a guest co-host today. I've had so many over the last several weeks. But I just think my guest today can handle it himself. I really think that I don't need a guest co-host because this man has done it all. He really doesn't need any introduction, but he's going to get one anyway, whether he likes it or not. And we don't have a studio audience here screaming, Jerry, Jerry, Jerry. But let's just say that the Jerry Springer talk show debuted in September of 1991. It's a few years ago. It had an amazing long run until 2018. And Judge Jerry has been on the air since 2019, the Jerry Springer Judge Show, which was recently canceled. But I think it may be providing him an opportunity for a well-deserved retirement after 50 years, 40 in front of the camera and 10 in politics. Yes, Jerry Springer was on the Cincinnati City Council and served as a mayor of Cincinnati. He worked with Senator Bobby Kennedy way back when. He's also an Emmy-winning nightly news anchor in Cincinnati. He has had so many successes, except last month, unfortunately, on his birthday, his beloved Cincinnati Bengals did not win the Super Bowl, but that's for another time. I love that chuckle. Jerry Springer, yeah. Welcome to Gervie's Law.
Well, thanks for having me. There's nothing I can say that's going to make it any better than what you just said. So, yeah.
It's funny you say that because, you know, I've had so many people on, and I always remember Alan Dershowitz who said, you know, when you introduced me, I really want to take a tape of that and play it every morning just to get me motivated to get up in the morning. You don't need any motivation.
Well, what I do is I tape the chanting, Jerry, Jerry, and when the alarm goes off in the morning, it comes out, Jerry, Jerry. No, it actually doesn't, but it would be fun if I did that.
You know, I recently saw a videotape of you watching your grandson hit a grand slam. That was excitement.
It was the happiest moment ever.
You know, it just shows you what kind of person you are that you can get so invested in your grandsons. And it was quite an accomplishment, a beautiful hit, but it was real. This is what's gotten you through all of these years of dealing with what some of us might say some mishigas, but you're able to have the motivation and the excitement because of the humanity inside of you.
Oh, you're very kind. But yeah, there's nothing like a grandkid. You keep hearing older people say that all the time, and you just kind of go, yeah, I know what you do. Yeah, yeah. And then when it actually happens, it just takes over your life. And, you know, I am consumed by him. And, the happiest thing about not doing a show anymore, because, you know, we've done it forever. In terms of being on television,
right.
Is that, right now he's down here with me in Florida for his spring break. And it's fantastic. It's, we get to be a kid all over again. I'm very lucky.
You are. And can you think of when you started your show way back when? And you had guests on the show like Oliver North or Jesse Jackson. And now you have your grandson, 13 years old, visiting with your daughter, Katie, and her husband, Richard, in Florida with you. What a dichotomy. How do you interpret your feelings and emotions now versus back then, when it was terribly exciting to have all of these people of some note on your show?
Well, I never mixed the two. I never mixed my career with my family. In other words, I always have kept that separate. And that is the easiest way to keep both. When you mix your career, particularly a public career, with your personal life, you ruin both. And so it's always been separate. In other words, when I was finished doing a show, and, you know, as exciting as that was, when I came home, I didn't come home thinking, oh, gee, all these people love me, you know, that were cheering. They loved the show, and, well, they were entertained by the show. And, but, you know, the important thing in life is that the people that are in your life love you. Then, you know, then you've lived a good life, or then there's some substance to it. So it never was difficult to do, simply because I knew this is my job. Maybe I would have had a job driving a truck, or, you know, working in a bank, whatever it was, that would be my job. But it wouldn't affect how much I loved my family, how much time I loved spending with them, going on vacations together. You know what I mean? And most people are like that. If you keep your job separate from your personal life, and you can be happy in both.
Do you think, by seeing some of the conflict that people on your show afterwards, and now we're moving on in time, not in the Oliver North, Jesse Jackson days, but when you went more entertainment-oriented, do you think after seeing some of that conflict that you appreciated your own life and own family more?
Well, the conventional wisdom kind of answer is, oh, yeah, I really do. You know, I'm so lucky that, you know, that's not my life, et cetera. But the truth is, you can't be a grown-up in today's world and not be aware that these things happen all the time, somewhere in your neighborhood, probably somewhere in your own family, you know, some relative.
Right.
There's, you know, you may be shocked that, you know, something that was on our show, if it happened to someone you know, that would be the shock.
Right.
But the idea that that activity happened, that it cannot be shocking in today's world. I mean, you know, all you have to do is, if people still read newspapers, open any newspaper in America, and by the time you're on page three, I've got 20 shows. So, you know, it's like, who are we kidding? This is a significant part of culture,
but you,
of our lives, you know, so I'm not surprised by it. No,
you learn that as you go through life. But you were 33 when you became mayor of Cincinnati. Isn't that a little too young?
Well, interestingly, I didn't think so at the time.
I hope not.
Yeah, but first of all, it was the greatest job I ever had, being mayor. So. Yeah. You know, nothing compared with that. And but politics was my passion. Show business was my career. But the passion, you know, I grew up in the, as a kid in the 50s, but basically, you know, school, high school and college and law school, that was the 60s. And I was a child of the 60s. I was, you know, back then they called us hippies. And, you know, I was part of the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement. Mm-hmm. And all I cared about was politics. I mean, you know, those issues. So I wasn't thinking career at all. It drove my parents crazy. But I could care less about making a living. You know, they basically said, as I was being raised by them, you know, you're either going to law school or medical school. So you can choose, but you'll do one or the other. You know, it was that kind of thing. Back then. And because I was really interested in all political issues, I just thought law school was probably a better background, though I never had any particular notion that I would be practicing law. And I right away went into politics. You know, I graduated from Northwestern, went to work for Bobby Kennedy, and then sadly when he was killed, a law firm in Cincinnati had recruited me while I was in law school and said, whenever you're ready to practice, come and practice. So I moved to Cincinnati, and I immediately ran for the United States Congress as an anti-war candidate. In other words, I was just crazy about those issues. And then, you know, my career, political career kind of took off. So, but I always knew I wouldn't make my living doing that.
You know,
and I think, go ahead.
No, I was listening. Go ahead. You think.
No, I think the one thing, one of the reasons why we have an extensive amount of corruption in politics is because too many people in it, that's how they make their living. And as soon as, you know, if you have a family and you're 40-something years old and you have to put food on the table and your job is serving in, whether it's Congress or the city council or whatever, you have to win the next election in order to keep putting food on the table. And particularly as you start getting a little bit older and say, you know what, if I lose, where am I going to find a job? What am I going to do? You know, it's pretty tough to get new jobs when you're 50 years old. You know, it's
but not every.
And so they get scared. And so they'll just do what they need to do to get elected, even though they don't really believe in what they're saying. Sometimes.
Right. You know, Jerry, not everyone thinks that way. We have to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk just a little bit about your background, being a son of a Jewish-German Holocaust survivors, and whether or not that had an impact on the passion that you have for the little guy and helping people throughout your lifetime. We'll talk about that after the break. We're talking to Jerry Springer. I'm Alan Gervie, and this is Gervie's Law.
Welcome back to Gervie's Law, lifting Murphy's Law to the highest level on AM 790 KABC.
We're talking to Jerry Springer. What an illustrious career, and something that has been part of his career, as he talked about in the first segment, was his service to others, saying that being the mayor of Cincinnati was the greatest job ever. Helping people out and having this service-oriented, assisting, helping others disposition really is something that I think Jerry has guided you through. It came from somewhere. Your parents obviously had a lot of obstacles coming to America from their background. Did they have a big impact on your way of thinking?
Oh, yeah, totally. Except for my mom and dad, my family was exterminated. We're German Jews, and they were exterminated in the concentration camps of Nazi Germany, and the camps were in Poland as well. But my mom and dad, they managed to get out of Germany 2 weeks, August 17th, of 1939, 2 weeks before Hitler went into Poland to start World War II, on September 1st. As soon as he went into Poland to start World War II, they shut the gates and no Jews were allowed out of Germany anymore, and at least not legally. And so mom and dad just got out and got to England, where my sister was born a month later, and then I was born during the war. But that's how close it was. But they lost, you know, my grandparents were exterminated, uncles, aunts, cousins, my dad's brother. So we lost the whole family. And then when I was five, mom and dad, they bought four tickets on the Queen Mary. And we came over to America in January of 49. And, you know, it's the whole coming to America story, immigrants not speaking English very well, and coming to New York and the Statue of Liberty. That whole ethic was basically the environment I was raised in. And so I grew up with these faded pictures on the wall of our apartment of all the family members who were gone. So that was the driving. It wasn't talked about very much. My parents couldn't talk about it. And the first few years, I came over when I was five, but
yeah.
Until I was five in England, we had a nanny. I mean, a nanny, she was a 17-year-old Irish girl. And because my parents didn't speak English, and my parents didn't want Evelyn and I speaking German at home because Germany was the enemy. So basically, it was Bridie who was speaking to us most of the time.
Yeah.
But anyway, so when we came to America, it very much had to do with how we viewed life. And I think my liberalism, which I guess was absorbed and was part of my DNA, became natural, because if the Holocaust had any lesson, and certainly there was no lesson intended, but if there was any lesson, it's that you never judge people based on what they are. You only judge people based on what they do. And that is what we teach our kids and our grandkids, is because if you do that, in other words, don't judge people based on what they are, you will never discriminate. You don't judge someone based on the fact that they happen to be black or Muslim or from someplace in Mexico or whatever it is. You judge the person based on how they behave and what they do. So, you can judge someone poorly or badly, but it's not based on what they are. It's how they behave. And I think using that, I think it's very hard. You can't ever think about discriminating. That's why this civil rights movement came very easily to me. It just seemed so natural. It really was good guys against the bad guys. How could a good person be in favor of segregation? How could a
right?
And I think that just sticks with you in life. And so it wasn't a hard lesson to learn. It was the only lesson I ever had, and I didn't have to be lectured to. It was just so obvious that, all the members of my family died, not because they did anything. It's just what they were.
What they were.
They happened to be Jewish, yeah.
It's such a simple concept, but it seems to be going farther and farther afield in today's world. When you talk about what we're experiencing, the way you've just articulated it, why don't people understand that? And you met so many people through, one of the things that I think impressed everyone is your ability on the show, on the Jerry Springer show, to be able to watch people who you may not have agreed with or who were out of control or whatever, but maintaining a very calm demeanor and allowing them to have their say. But at the same time, there must have been so many values and principles that you just didn't agree with. How do you contain yourself under those circumstances?
Well, because it's logical. If you think about it, I guess, because 99% of what we are, we had nothing to do with. I mean, there's not one human being on the planet Earth, not one, who had anything to do with the decision to be born. To whom they'd be born,
yep.
In what era, in what country, to what parents, with what kind of brain, with what kind of health. You could take Bill Gates, incredibly successful American. If he had been born in Ethiopia, he would have been dead at the age of five. So it's like, who are we kidding? So therefore, if I'm on stage and, there's just some wacky behavior going on, and maybe they didn't have the luck in the gene pool of parents that I did. And that could be me up there. I mean, I never thought I was better than anyone who was ever on the show. I was just luckier. And I know that. And I think most successful people deep down really know that. When they're
but they don't act that
room,
way. That's the problem.
Well,
you are able to maintain a way of behaving and acting based on that premise. But so many people don't.
Well, I think there is a the most powerful political emotion is resentment. People resent, I mean, in terms of racism, people
right.
just resent that someone else is getting something, perhaps they're not. They're getting a benefit. Yeah, how come my tax dollars are going to help them? I mean, how good is my life? Why do I have to pay more taxes? I don't have a kid in the public schools. You know, this kind of
right.
thing. It's the people, you know, we get a little bit selfish and we resent other people getting ahead or being more. And that is why oftentimes we get people in the lower income strata fighting each other. Because they're competing for the last jobs there, for the last government programs that are going out. How come it's going to them and not me? Look at our neighborhood. You know, I don't have that. I mean, that's why, you know, when we, you know, when politicians throw up out, well, middle America, oh, about the working man, as if the working man isn't an African American. I mean, when we say the working man and woman, we're thinking of middle and lower income whites. They're the ones laboring when, you know.
That's not the reality.
It isn't. And the, you know, if we're honest with ourselves, America was built on largely on the backs of initially slaves, but then minorities because
and immigrants.
When I say the immigrants, because they didn't have to be paid a lot of money. So we got cheap labor, and therefore it was cheap labor that built our schools and hospitals and highways and bridges and homes. And we go to restaurants, and the bill isn't as high as it might otherwise be because there's some immigrant in the back in the kitchen. You know, working for pennies, and we benefit by other people being kept down. And so we all benefit. So when we say the country was built in large part on the backs of usually immigrants of color, that's just been our history. And it certainly started out like that. You know, an African-American, a slave was 3/5 of a person. And that's just the way it was. And you see all these beautiful plantations and all these big homes that were built there. And with the few exceptions, our founding fathers were living this great life because they had a whole bunch of slaves.
Well, I think that's it's a good argument for respecting everyone. And when you talk about you never felt any better than anyone else. I know, as Judge Jerry, which must have been so much fun to do that show, you had an opportunity.
Yeah, I love that, sure.
You had an opportunity to impact people's lives because they are looking to you for wisdom, for some kind of guidance in problems. We have to take a quick break. But after the break, I want to talk a little bit about your experience as Judge Jerry and whether you're going to miss it. And maybe talk a little bit about the Jerry Springer podcast, which can be found at jerryspringer.com, because so many ideas and values that you're talking about today can be found on your website, jerryspringertv.com and jerryspringer.com for the podcast. I want to hear from Jerry. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Welcome back to Gervie's Law, turning Murphy's Law upside down. on AM 790 KABC.
Is this the choice of music? The Jerry Springer theme music. Amazing. One of the things that Jerry Springer has not been talking to us about so far, and we're going to get back to Judge Jerry in a minute, but when we listen to that music, we think about Jerry Springer's love for music. I got to ask you, Jerry, is it really true that when you were mayor of Cincinnati, that you decided to give the keys to the city to your favorite musical acts, like Bob Dylan or Linda Ronstadt, the Eagles, and Prince, just so you could meet them?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Well, look, I was, you know, 32, 33 years old. And obviously this was the middle and late 70s. And those were my musical idols. And now all of a sudden, oh my gosh, I'm a mayor of the city. I'm one of the, you know, other than the serious job of running a city, you know, you have ceremonial things and, you know, occasionally gave a key to the city. And it suddenly struck me, one of my campaign issues, actually, and they made fun of me because of it, is I said I was going to bring rock and roll to Cincinnati, because Cincinnati at the time was a very conservative, you know, buttoned down community. And here I was, this hippie from New York, you know, and I get elected. And one of my campaign promises was, as I said, bringing rock and roll to Cincinnati. And so when I got elected, in fact, they ran this huge cartoon on the front page of the Cincinnati Inquirer of me, the gavel, saying, now here come the Rolling Stones. And what we did is we had Riverfront Stadium, which is where the Reds and
right.
the Bengals play.
I remember.
And when you have, and this, you know, the city and the county put up the money to build that stadium right on the river. And but, you know, the Bengals play only 8 home games a season. It was a 16-game season back then. So only 8 days a year is the stadium being used for the Bengals, and only 81 days a year was the stadium being used for the Reds.
Right.
A half a season. So therefore, you're basically left with, you know, 250-odd, little more days a year when it's empty. So I said, we are going to have a summer concert for, you know, for the young people. And, you know, I really loved Linda Ronstadt. And so I got in touch with her agent and then talk with her about, would she come to Cincinnati and host our first ever outdoor rock concert. And it would go from 2 in the afternoon till 11 at night. And she wasn't able to get the dates that we wanted, but she said, I can get you the Eagles. So on August 16th, 1978... Riverfront Stadium, 60,000 people there, most of them under 30, for the Eagles, Eddie Money, and the Steve Miller Band.
Wow, what a lineup.
And yeah, now it's August, and it had AstroTurf, and you can imagine how hot it would be starting at 2 in the afternoon. And we didn't want riots breaking out, fights breaking out. Drugs were an issue. That's why the whole
you saved that for later in your career on your show, but you didn't want it at that time.
Yeah. Well, no, and the fear was the whole city council was opposed to it because they said it would just be a drug infested thing. And I said, look, we're not have any drugs. I, you know, gave press conferences talking to the kids. I said, look, if we want to continue to have this, can't be any drugs. And there's not going to be any liquor sold there. And to keep everyone cool, we set up showers around the field because the people were on the field. You know, they had a tarp over it.
Right.
But you can imagine the whole stadium covered and 60,000 people, some in the stands, but mostly them down on the field. We had showers all around to keep people cool. what I didn't realize is that that was the largest wet T-shirt company that we
I was waiting for that. Oh, yeah. My goodness.
Oh, man.
But they anyway, must have loved it. So, it must have been a huge success.
It was. And at the end, which was the most fun I had, was when the Eagles called me up on stage, to thank for the concert, et cetera. And they said, why don't you sing a song with us? And I said, like an idiot, do you know Lying Eyes? Like, do you know?
they might know it.
At the time.
Yeah.
So I got to sing Lying Eyes with the Eagles. And that was the era when all the people in the audience had their lighters out, their flashlights or lighters, and just, swaying from side to side. I mean, it was such a great moment.
Amazing.
But anyway, so I wanted to meet these stars. So I gave the key to Bob Dylan and Dolly Parton and Emmylou Harris and everyone that I liked. I would call up and say, we'd like it. And they would come and do a concert in Cincinnati.
Did any of them disappoint you, or did they all live up to your expectations?
Every one of them was nice. Now, why, they come into the mayor's office, they're obviously polite and whatever. Actually, the greatest one was Dylan, because he came, I gave him the key backstage before the concert, and he asked everyone to get out of the room. So it's just he and I in his dressing room. And I gave him the key, and we talked for 20 minutes, and he had just returned from Nuremberg, where he did a very controversial concert there. But he was, because he's my age, he was fascinated about what it's like to be a mayor. Here he is, Bob Dylan, and he's going, hey, man, what's it like being a mayor? What do you do? And, and it's like, gosh, how great.
Why didn't you ask him if you could change places for a day?
Oh, man.
Wow, that's something wonderful. Else. Yeah. I mean, it sounds so gratifying. And, back in the day, you were a broadcaster as well. And you even had an opportunity to interview who I think I can say cynically and sarcastically your hero, Donald Trump, when you were a broadcaster. What is the story of his middle initial? Because I don't think all our listeners know about that.
He says it's G for genius. No.
J.
I
joke.
J. He says it's J for genius.
J for genius.
That's what he says. It's J for genius.
Did you have the disdain for him back then that you do now?
No. Okay, I didn't interview him. What the story with Trump was, he owned the Miss Universe pageant. And so since he owned it, he asked me if I would host it. This was in 2008.
Wow.
And that year, the Miss Universe pageant was in Vietnam. So I worked for him for that year or for those few months. And he was very nice to me, so I don't have any personal story where he was not nice. But it didn't dawn on any human being that this guy would one day run for president or be president. I mean, it never even crossed your mind. So there was nothing in him that, you would think had any competence to or had any political views. I mean, this guy was wanted to be in showbiz.
So
he wanted to make money is what he wanted. But there was nothing about anything political. So I was shocked when all of a sudden you started to hear stories that he was going to run. And it's not personal, but he had no business being president of the United States. I mean, I love my daughter, but I don't think she should be president. It's like, how does someone get off having never served in public office, having never run any public institution, which is totally different than the private sector.
Right.
Because the private sector is, you do it for profit. The public sector, you do it for public service, to provide services. And that he never even thinks about that. And so he had no business running, and it was disrespectful to our country to think that, oh, United States of America, don't worry, I'll lead you. It's like, God forbid, your kid has to go to the hospital and needs, you know, life-saving surgery. You want to know that the surgeon at least went to medical school. You know, why do we
right.
have such little respect
but
for America?
Isn't it ironic?
Someone like that could be president.
But isn't it ironic that that's probably the platform that was successful because people were looking for, apparently, someone who wasn't in what he would call the swamp.
Yeah, but see, that gets to be the name calling and all that, but it's not a grown-up that really understands how government works and all the intricacies. You know, he had no skill in it.
Right.
It was just bravado. And eventually, by the end of his term, the only people around him were basically his family or a bunch of crazy people that now got indicted.
Right. We have to take a break. But when we come back, we're going to have final thought from Jerry Springer. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KVC.
Listening to Gervie's Law, the intersection of law and life on AM 790 KABC.
Yes, you are listening to Gervie's Law, and we are having a great time getting up close and personal with Jerry Springer. A long career of service, of entertainment, of politics, of law. And Jerry, when it comes down to it, do you still feel your mantra, take care of yourself and each other, is appropriate? And if so, why?
Yeah, because it's when we forget that. During the 80s, it was the me generation. And in fact, even all the commercials you would see, I mean, the books that came out, you know, You're Number One, or for the hair coloring,
right.
I think it was Clairol or whatever it was, you know, you're worth it. You're not, you know, do it. You're worth it. You're number one, taking care of number one. So there was no problem in getting people to concentrate on themselves. But if we're going to exist as a society, we've got to think about taking care of each other too. That's just being a good person. That's something your mom taught you when you were 2 years old, playing with toys, and Johnny was in the room with you, and your mom would say, you know, share your toys with Johnny. It's just human decency. So we should be concerned about taking care of each other. Not just if everyone just worries about themselves and no one else, everyone will have a time in their life when they need help. Everyone. It could be a bad report from a doctor. It could be your business goes south. It could be, war. It could be whatever it is. Something is going to happen in your life, and you're going to need the assistance of somebody else. You know, we all hated the government, but come 9/11, we wanted the government to put security in our airports. You know,
that's right.
Right away, everyone, no one wants the government until they need help. There's a fire. You call the fire department, you know?
It became more and more clear over the last couple of years. When you say that everyone is going to experience some kind of trauma or crisis or problem, we saw that with the pandemic because it's been indiscriminate.
Exactly. And oftentimes the people that are most, at least publicly, have been against, you know, it's just a hoax,
right.
or you know, don't take the vaccine, or you don't have to wear a mask and all this. And then you see, sadly, tragically, they get very sick or they die. And you see these stories all the time. It's like, what attitude does a person have to have, for example, for not wearing a mask at the time that they wanted people to wear masks? In other words, even if you're not afraid of getting it, wouldn't you want to wear a mask so that people around you can feel safe? I mean, how selfish do you have to be to say, well, it's freedom. This is a free country.
Right. Well, apparently,
we don't have freedom to hurt other people.
Apparently, we have found out, and I agree with you, Jerry, apparently we have found out how selfish you have to be. I mean, that's maybe what is the most upsetting and frustrating part, is that's been a consequence of what we've all experienced, seeing, you know, it's interesting you talk about the dichotomy of the me generation back then, but it seems that maybe it's reared its ugly head over the last couple of years, and it's become apparent more so than we ever thought. And that's
a great point.
That's what's frustrating.
Yep. Yeah.
You know, we talk about your show, and I'm just backtracking. I'm looking at it. Says, in 1999, you were the number one daytime show, beating Oprah Winfrey.
Yeah, yeah.
Why was that? I mean, there was a lot of people who said, oh, the show isn't all real. There's some scripting going on. The security people are actors and that sort of thing. Why do you think you were able to become number one? And was it because maybe some of it was embellished, or there was entertainment value where people were really starving for that?
Well, there clearly was entertainment value. That's clear. But the show was real. And by the way, the security guys were Chicago police officers. And then Connecticut police officers, as the show later on moved to Connecticut. The show was real. In fact, the guests sit in a room with the camera rolling and the lawyers there, and you have to sign a document swearing that your story is real and you are liable, legally liable, if it's not. And that usually scares off those that are making up the story.
Sure.
So, you know, they sit in the room and then they say, well, and they have some kind of excuse. Yeah, I'm nervous. I don't want to go on, that kind of thing. So we get a lot of that. So and plus, the producers over 27 years get to be pretty sophisticated in figuring out when a story is real and when it's not. And they have to produce documents to prove, you know, did you really live there? Did you really, you know, pay rent there? Whatever. Or there have to be documents to support the story. Now, because people that are on the show, the only way you get on that crazy show was you have to call and ask to be on. I mean, it's not the kind of show where you could just call people out of the blue and say, hey, want to be on Jerry Springer? You say, what? You'd be scared to death. You wouldn't do it. So the only people that get on the show are people who call us. And the only people who call us are people who have watched the show 1,000 times, because we're not in the phone book. The only place you know our number is because it's on the screen. So therefore, people that call the show, come on the show, are people that have seen the show so often that they know the drill. They know that the audience is going to be cheering and screaming. So you could embellish your reactions. For example, it could be the same story on Oprah, and the people would have absolutely behaved themselves.
Because they watched the show.
Right, because you're on Oprah. You don't do that on Oprah, but they figured, oh, this show.
Yeah, I don't understand how people don't get that. You know, I worked at NBC many years ago, and we did a lot of, making sure the legal liability issues and everything, and people don't get it. They think, oh, lawyers don't do their job, but clearly you had a team of them, and I would probably say you weren't sued very much, and if you were, they weren't successful.
Well, there were a few, but no, they were never successful. But what also I think what also is the case is there's no reason to fake the stories.
No.
The real stories. Look at what, as I said, read the newspapers or whatever. Look at what's happening every single day, internationally, nationally, in your hometown. What could you possibly make up that is more outrageous
right.
than what really
That's
happened?
That's right. It's life. You know? It's real. We only have
exactly.
We only have a couple minutes. Talk a little bit for 30 seconds on the Jerry Springer podcast. Must be so much fun to do that.
I love doing it. It's on every week. All you do is just Google jerryspringer.com and then go to podcasts. And they have, we've been doing it for 6 or 7 years now. And every week there's another subject. So you look at the subject you like. The last 2 or 3 weeks I've been doing it on Ukraine.
Yeah.
So it, there's, you know, it's a 30-minute podcast. So for 10 minutes, I do my political rant. For 10 minutes, I do it with my best friend, and we've been friends for 45 years, and we did it at a coffee shop in Ludlow, Kentucky, before a live audience. Now with the pandemic, we do it by Zoom. But so we joke around for about 10 minutes on what's going on in the world or whatever, some silly thing that happened. And then the last 10 minutes, it's music. But the music is, we do roots music, which is... old-time bluegrass
yeah.
Folk music, and we get musicians from all over the country that, as they pass through the Midwest, they come and do our podcast, and that for 10 minutes, they play their original music, and we have some great bands.
It really is great. I've been listening to it, and people should tune in, the Jerry Springer podcast. It's got all of what Jerry's talking about. 10 seconds, Jerry. Final thought.
May you never be on my show. Take care of yourself and each other.
You know what? I have been so honored to have you on my show. I may never be on your show,
Alan,
but this
you're
is,
a good guy. Yeah.
This has been a great pleasure, Jerry. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Alan. Thanks for having me. Take care of yourself.
You too. Bye-bye. Be well. All right. That's going to do it. Jerry Springer. What a show. Thanks for listening. I'm Alan Gervey. We'll see you next week.